Hey there, welcome to In Full Color, a podcast on race, community, and justice. My name is Taylor McGee, and I'm your host. And I'm so excited to welcome you to season two of the podcast. Whether you are a new or returning listener, this season's going to highlight the most pressing issues connected to racial justice, while also continuing to explore the intersections between race and identity. To kick things off is a two-part episode with Charlie Michael and Suba Xavier. In this episode, they share their experiences as an interracial couple in the beginnings of their multiracial family as they lived in the U.S. and also abroad. Next week, we'll be talking more specifically about their approaches to raising their two sons. I hope you enjoy. So, to start off, can you please tell me who you are, what do you do, and how do you identify racially and or ethnically?
Okay, I'll go first. I am Charlie Michael. I am a professor, assistant professor of film at Georgia Gwinnett College, and I identify as white.
Hi, my name is Suba Xavier. I am associate professor of French at Emory University. I specialize in issues of migration and race studies and the literature of sub-Saharan Africa. I identify as Sri Lankan, which is what my ethnic origin is. My parents are from the two different ethnic communities of Sri Lanka, so I've always thought of myself as already being multi-ethnic or multiracial in some ways, because those two ethnicities have always claimed different races, although I don't think that's biologically founded. Mm-hmm. And I identify as really as a woman of color, I'd say, in the last many years of living in the U.S. And then I grew up in Canada, so I very much identify as a Canadian and a Quebecer as well, which is, I grew up in Montreal, speaking French. I think my identity is very much that of somebody who's multilingual and multicultural, multi-ethnic.
Awesome. And you both kind of touched on this, but how did your life experiences inform your own identity as you are right now?
That's a complicated question. So I'll start. I was a political refugee at the age of 8. We fled a war between two ethnic communities in Sri Lanka. And like I said, my two parents are from the two different opposing communities. So for me, a lot of my experience has been shaped by that power dynamic and the experience of flight, the experience of love as well, but love that's very complicated and not easy across difference. And then we fled to Holland because initially there was no country that was recognizing what was going on in Sri Lanka as a civil war. So Holland was one of the only countries that did. So we lived as a family in Holland for a while. My parents were not together at this time. My father fled first, and then my mother fled second with the children. I have two brothers. So we were in Holland for a while, and then we fled to Canada because Canada recognized what was going on in Sri Lanka as a civil war. And I grew up in Montreal from the age of 9. So we were in Toronto for a year, and then Montreal from the age of 9. Learning French, going to a French school in an immersion program. I grew up with mostly white people around me and also, you know, various communities of color. There were many immigrant communities in Montreal where I grew up. And I think I would say I mostly identified as an immigrant. It's probably how I thought of myself. And growing up, I didn't have all that many white friends because the immigrant communities tended to recognize each other in some ways, but I had a lot of friends from various communities. So it wasn't only people who were brown skin like me, but really different ethnicities and colors of skin. And then, you know, I did make a lot of white friends over the years. Initially, they were those who no one else wanted to be friends with. Mm. And then over the years, it became more of the mainstream. So I had a kind of gradual coming into mainstream culture. And mainstream white culture, I mean. And then I've lived in many different countries, even since I became an adult. And Charlie and I actually met in France, so we can tell you about that later. Yeah. So, you know, living in Canada, living in France, living in the U.S., and I traveled a lot as a student as well, visited many countries. I've been to Asia and Africa, many African countries as well. So I would say that my sense of who I am is informed by all of that. Mm. And it's my life experience has been really colored, literally, figuratively, by just being around a lot of different people and learning to find myself within those groups. Yeah.
So that whole story, it's funny because our first date, really, what that whole story that Suba, that fascinating sort of multi-ethnic story that Suba told, she told it to me the first time we went out, and I'm sort of filled with the same sort of feeling right now that I just feel like I had the privilege. That's a word I didn't have at the time we met, but I had the privilege of not thinking about my race at all, which means that I just, identified as white, but I didn't think that I was identifying as anything. So growing up, I grew up in, you know, in the lily white town of Oxford, Ohio. Not that there aren't any people of color there, but I just thought that there were different people and everyone was kind of just humans. And I didn't think race was really I didn't think it was really that a thing. Like I knew it was a thing, but I thought we were all equal. I really did.
Yeah.
But now that you asked the question, I've been thinking while Sue was talking, did I have any exposure, exposure to difference as a kid? And I did, because my two best friends as a young boy, one was Indian and one was biracial. So half white, half black. So the two kids that I was closest to as a little boy were actually not white. It's just that I didn't, it wasn't something that I was actively thinking about, but I think it certainly in retrospect, probably informed who I am today. You know, I was definitely, comfortable with them. And
yeah.
So.
And we have to tell you about the line.
Oh boy, I'm going to bring that up. So this is the infamous or famous. This is the infamous or famous line. So my best friend, growing up, was Indian
and
Indian American. He's second generation. His parents came from India before he was born. He was the best man at our wedding as well. And before we had that first date, when Suba and I first met, I, of course, thought that that was useful information, something that might help me.
You see where this is going.
Might help me chat up this beautiful woman that I was meeting. And so I said, right after saying hello, how are you? My first line was, I have an Indian friend. And Suba's response was very graceful, and she said, "Well, that's great. I'm Sri Lankan."
Oh my gosh!
And so then, of course, my friend, when he was in our wedding, when he was giving his roast of the groom, brought this up, and his first line was brilliant. He said, "I like to think that I'm directly responsible for this couple coming together." But I mean, it's both funny, and actually, it's true. I mean, it's because he kind of, I think, unbeknownst to me growing up, he and my other friend, I don't think I would have been comfortable, probably, or as comfortable dating someone from another background if I hadn't been friends with them. So, I mean, I think in a way it's ironic, but it's also, there's a truth to it.
Yeah, totally. You both kind of talked about being in like different spaces around the world and how you both met in France. And so I guess we can dive into that, because I think what a lot of people don't quite understand is how we construct race and how we think about it isn't the same in every place. And so I would love to hear more about how you all met and how you've navigated being in an interracial relationship in different places around the world.
It's a good question. You want to start?
I think it's when we met in a city called Rennes, which is in northwest of France.
The old capital of Brittany.
in what's called Bretagne. And in some ways, meeting so far from home is a very freeing thing, because you feel like you can shed so much of the things, the baggage you carry. So Charlie was certainly not the first white guy I'd met, but to meet him in France was to meet him in a different way, to meet him as a North American, which was something we shared, because I was coming from Canada, he was coming from the US. And in that sense, we were different. We were both bilingual, so to be an English speaker in a French-speaking environment was kind of freeing. And then my story dislocated from the country that I had fled to and the country I'd been a refugee in, and it, and all of that baggage, all of that, what it means to be a refugee somewhere, which is basically a sense of that, that you, you're grateful that, that this country opened its doors to you. So I had grown up with that, but that sense of gratitude, you know? And then you're suddenly in France, I didn't have to be grateful. I mean, it wasn't that sense of gratitude. I just could be me, you know, and I could just claim the space in a different way. And I did. And so I think to meet Charlie there was really important for me. I don't know if I would have been as open and as confident with who I was and my past if it was in Canada, where somehow there was a different story that I told about myself. So I think that telling Charlie that story that first day was really, it was a different way of telling that story for me that was really liberating. And then I grew up speaking French, so French was very much almost a native language to me, but then to speak it in France was different because I was always recognized as being different. The French are very candid. They ask you point blank all the time who you are and where you're from, you know, and whenever I'd say I was from Canada, they'd say, well, why don't you sound like Celine Dion? Why is your French, you know? And I grew up around a lot of immigrants, so I had a very standardized French accent. I could put on the Quebecois accent whenever I needed it, but I didn't speak in that accent. So people in France were always asking me about that as well. And, you know, it was just, France is in some ways more open to race in that they acknowledge it all the time. And in many ways, they're more close to race in that they don't like to account for it in any way. They pretend in all institutional places that it does not exist. So it's this dual relationship to race. And I think being in it made me more bold. It made me speak about it more openly, call people out more openly, I mean, in kind ways, like I did with Charlie. I mean, I would never have responded negatively if somebody thought I was Indian. I mean, that's when you're brown, you're just used to being called off things. And, you know, and a lot of people even think I'm an Ethiopian because I have very, very curly hair. And so they always say, oh, you know, and you learn to respond, and you learn to respond in playful ways. You respond, you know, you learn to engage the conversation. And I think I learned to engage it and not make it go away. And before then, I was definitely put my head down and just, I'm whatever you want me to be, is I think the way I grew up. I have a very complicated first name. My first full name is Subanyana, so no one can pronounce it. I always go by Suba because that's what they call me at home. But even my name, I mean, I always, when people would say, how do you pronounce it? I'd say, any way you want to. I respond to anything that sounds like my name. So I wasn't that kid who was correcting people. And it, you know, it took adulthood. It took going away to France to learn to claim my identity, to claim who I was, to playfully engage with all these issues. And I think it's cool that Charlie was part of that coming to be, coming into myself. Because I think meeting him at that time was very critical.
So, I mean, we're both 24 when we meet, and we meet in between. So we both finished our master's degrees. So we were, you know, kind of around the stage, probably you are right now, right? Or I don't know how, what you're, if you're finished at Emory yet. But sort of like, you know, we were the sophomores. We weren't like first year students, but we thought we were really old and smart. We thought we were these wise, but we were wise fools, mm. you know? And so, you know, now we've been together for 20 years. So looking back on it, you know, I really thought of myself as a really mature person. Mm-hmm. And I thought of myself as someone who knew how to navigate the world. When now looking back, I'm kind of like, no, not really, not at all. So again, you know, when I went to France, I would not say that in any way I was woke, as we say now, to the reality of inequalities or inequality. It's kind of the white experience, right? You intellectually understand by that age that there is inequality,
yeah.
but you don't know what it means to be a minority, like yeah. what it means to, so that's something I'm still learning, like now. So at the time, I mean, you know, I was just, I think just stumbling through in and out of kind of offensive, saying offensive things that I didn't realize were offensive. It's the white experience, really. It's like, I remember you have to go back to this comment. Like when I said, I have an Indian friend, I really thought that that was, at the time, I really thought that that was like a nice thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's embarrassing. And then I was immediately recognized it afterwards. Like I was mortified when she told me that she was Sri Lankan, but not mortified for the right reason.
Yeah.
Like I was mortified
that he got it wrong.
That I got it wrong. And then I was really apologetic, mm. you know, but it wasn't, there was no, like, there wasn't the reflection of what my blunder meant, what it meant about my view of the world, you know, and that stuff yeah. I'm still unpacking now. And, you know, it's really it's a microaggression. It's yeah. like, I didn't have that language at the time. And, you know, Suba certainly has told me also now that, you know, it meant a lot that I was mortified and apologetic to mm. her, that a lot of people, as soon as she said, oh, it doesn't matter, they'd be like, you know, it'd be like water off a duck's back. They would mm-hmm. be like, oh, she would absolve them of any kind of guilt. Yeah. And I was, you know, I felt guilty. I still feel guilty for the comment, right? So I think that's part of kind of what allowed me, I mean, I'll let Suba speak to this, but I think that's, that sensitivity probably plays a role in what our connection, in that I, mm. even though I didn't have any kind of any kind of awareness at that time of really the dynamics I'm talking about now, there was a sensitivity, I think, to that she probably was feeling something that she wasn't saying.
Mm.
And, you know, as I said before, when I was growing up, I didn't have a lot of close white friends. Most of my close friends had always been of different ethnic and racial groups. So to really become intimate and close to somebody who was white, it had to be somebody special. I mean, it just had to be somebody mm. who, you know, and I think Charlie, despite that initial blunder, is just, was really open and sensitive and always listened. Mm. And he was just a different kind of white guy, you know?
Yeah.
And quite frankly, there just aren't a lot of them. I can tell you now, 20 years later, there's very few of them. And so it was something special. It was something that I recognized right away as a person with whom we could create a space that felt safe, that felt open, and that truly was, I think, an equal, a space of equality.
Mm.
And I think over the years, we navigated, you know, we left France to go to graduate school in Wisconsin, and that was not easy. I mean, Wisconsin is wonderful. We made a lot of friends, but it's a very, very segregated city, and yes. the university at the time was so white.
Madison, you're talking about Madison.
Yes, Madison, yeah. Wisconsin, the University of Madison. It's a lot less white university today. I mean, it still has a long way to go, but my goodness, when I was there.
It's Wisconsin.
I felt so alone. I mean, it was just a very lonely experience. But then I gravitated towards these professors. I mean, my dissertation advisor is a Congolese man. I mean, you know, there was just, I found my people, so to speak. You know, I found the people mm-hmm. who could inspire me. I found the people alongside who I could work. And so then I was able to navigate that situation. And as a couple, we did. I mean, that was our early married life in a city as students. And little by little, you know, I would say to him things like, I can't wait to get out, you know, or we need to find a more ethnically diverse community to live in and to have children in when we do get to that stage. And I'm also an Indian classical dancer, and one of the big outlets I had was that I danced a lot in Wisconsin. So I found a dance troupe and I danced throughout my entire PhD. I danced a lot, almost every day.
Wow.
It was very intense, but I needed that community so much to help me get through those years. So after that, we went to Miami. That was my first job. And that was a very different community. It was very Hispanic. It was a hard time, I think, for Charlie, because I learned Spanish and Charlie struggled to learn the language. And it's a very ethnically diverse place, and yet it's mostly diverse in that it's a mostly Latina and Hispanic community. Mm-hmm. And so that was another interesting place to navigate, where everybody just assumed I was Latin American, and so I could pass as second generation Latin American with my bad Spanish, you know.
Suba is chameleonic. This is, you know, she is able to. She had an Irish roommate when she lived in Paris, and within a weeks of having this Irish roommate, when she went and visited Ireland, people thought she was from Ireland. Like she could just adopt the accent. So this is something you need to know about her. She's a shapeshifter, in a way that I think probably a lot of multiracial folks are too, but not, you know, sure. Like with code switching, and also, but it's not just code switching. It's like with accents, she's very gifted, which obviously those two things are related. I am very much not. So I am, you know, I am just Charlie from Ohio, wherever I go. And you know, there's good things and bad things about that. It's fortunate again for me that I'm a white guy, right? That a white guy gets certain privileges.
Yeah.
Going to different places. But yeah, it was hard for me in Miami. It was hard, mostly because of other reasons, though. I was still working on my PhD. There were other external stresses. It wasn't necessarily the Hispanophone environment that was the cause of my stress, I would say.
We had our first son there. And that was interesting because I felt like everything went so well for me, in that I felt really at home, and I loved the fact that there were all these different shades of brown and black, and you know, there's little Haiti where I was working with the community there as part of my teaching. I started civic engagement courses with my students. I was taking my students to little Haiti. It was just wonderful in so many ways. And then I became a mother, and our son was born with blue eyes and was really white. He was really fair skinned. He still is, but he was super.
I'm not just white. I'm like really white. Like yes. I'm very fair skinned. So even white people, when they meet me, they're like Suba's brother, when we first got together and he heard about me, he saw a picture of us, and he actually sort of quietly asked Suba if I was albino, which, because I was wearing, I was wearing like shades. So you couldn't see my eye, you know, Anyway, so I'm very, pigment challenged. So the nurse, I remember she saw me and she's like, oh, your son, he's going to look just like you. And I'm like, thank you. And then she's like, and you know what? I know this. I've been a nurse for 20 years. I can tell he's going to have blonde hair and blue eyes. And I'm kind of like, I was like, are you sure about that? Have you seen his mother?
They'd
never seen her, so they didn't know. And so it was very strange. That was my first experience of, you know, like assumptions being made. And I'm, again, you know, both of our sons, right? They'll probably change as they grow, I think. But right now they're both very fair. And so they pass as white boys.
Mm. When I was on maternity leave and I'd be pushing this stroller that I researched a lot before I got this really nice stroller, and we got it as a gift. And so I'm pushing my kid in this really nice stroller, and people would always assume I was a nanny. They would say, can you ask
his mother,
his mom, where she bought this stroller? And that was always, the entire time we were there, you know, they would say, you know, Hispanic community is very vocal around children, and so they'd be like, oh, qué lindo, what a beautiful baby. And they'd say like, oh, he must have a beautiful mother, or, you know, a beautiful father, things like that. And, you know, talking to me as though I was the nanny. And, you know, again, it was one of those things that took me so much by surprise that it took me, you know, a year before I had a reply, because it would always shock me. And I just look at them thinking, what? Oh, right, right. No one thinks this is my child.
But I think in America, there, you have to be a chameleon, because that you, society is set up in a way for you not to just choose one specific race or culture or however you're going to express that, but okay, if you choose one, fine. But if you don't choose one, you have to be able to navigate all these different spaces as if you belong in them. And so I get, people start speaking Spanish to me all the time. I don't know a lick of Spanish. I'm not Hispanic. I get that I'm tan and I have curly brown hair, but it's just interesting to see how, I'm always fascinated by people who are of different racial backgrounds, or in couples who are different than, say, my parents or my own identity. There's this inherent quality of being in a multiracial kind of unit where you have to adapt to the space that you're in. And I think it's easier to do that in a very diverse space, right? If you are in Miami, or if you're in Atlanta, like there's a lot of racial and ethnic diversity, but they're different kinds of diversity, and you still have to navigate what that looks like. Was it important to make sure that your kids grew up in a diverse space? Was that for, because you wanted to avoid having them experience the same feelings that you were having? Or was that just something you valued, being in as an interracial couple, that was something you wanted to emulate with your kids, of not existing in like a racially homogenous space? Or just why was that important for you to raise your kids in a very diverse space?
For me, it was a non-negotiable, to be honest. So as academics, that limited where we would go as professors. Yeah. Because as you know, there's all these universities all over this country in small little towns that I would just see these job announcements and I'd say, no way. And Charlie would say, well, why not? It's a great university. It's got a great reputation. And I'd say, no, I can't live there. I can't live there if I can't go out of my house and people look at me weird, or I have to justify myself every second of every day. Which I already do a lot of. You know?
And that's, I will say too that conversation about where we're going to settle down has been a ongoing source of tension, but also growing understanding. I mean, it's like we've moved a lot from Madison to Miami to Atlanta, and we've had multiple other potential moves as as academic couple too. There's that whole piece, right? Because we're both looking for permanent, in fact, we've just found for the first time both permanent academic employment this year, and that's after 10 years of seeking it. So that's a whole nother piece of our life, that irrespective of race. But so for me, my attitude was not, it obviously, again, not race was not the first consideration. My first consideration was like, we just need to find a place where we can both get jobs. And again, I recognize also that, you know, that was, I had a privilege to be able to put that first, because I felt like I could be comfortable in most places. And so I fully recognize that now, but then again, there's a difference in recognizing that and then also just being without a job and trying to figure out, you know, there's the other piece of it, which is being financially stable with a family.
Sure.
You want them to have a diverse environment, but you also want to have enough resources to raise them. So that's been a delicate balancing act, trying to prioritize these different factors throughout the last decade or so that we've had children and that we've been seeking a place to settle down.
And settle down, maybe. I think for me, you know, even living in Atlanta, we've lived in Atlanta now for 6 years, and we just now bought a house, and it was not an easy decision.
No,
it was completely because of race. Yeah. Because, you know, where we live is so important to me, and it's just, none of it is easy. And for me, I would say that it's so critical that my children see people who are different from them every day, not like once a week, not, you know, every day, and different in of every sort. And I think that's why I like about cities, because I think that you find that a little more readily. But that being said, even a place like Atlanta is so segregated.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to find difference. And and we struggled, and we finally just bought a place, but after a lot of back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and me saying, let's just move to Black Atlanta. I just want to live in Black Atlanta, you know, and Charlie saying, well, we need to move somewhere we can afford. And me saying, no, but I don't want a place where, because my kids are white passing, I don't want, and this is what we noticed in the last place we lived, was that they just were completely, especially my older son, sort of assimilated into white culture. And I'd never known that culture, you know, and yeah. I saw its roots, and it scared me to my very core. I mean, it shook me to my very core to see how, I saw how institutional racism begins.
Yeah.
And it begins with the children.
Yes.
You know, and after that, I was just kind of looking for somewhere to go where I knew, you know, things would be different. And there were many times Charlie said, well, let's just pull him out and put him in a middle school that's close by. And I said, no, you know, because the teachers are Black too. I mean, the vast majority of teachers are Black, and that's important to me. And the musicians and the artists are Black, and that's important. And of course, there are white musicians too, and they're white artists, but sure. I need him to see them and look up to them and learn from them. And because that's, I think, how we get to more racial justice in this country. You know, I think we need to admire people who are look very different and sound very different and have all kinds of different backgrounds that they draw in from, and that you realize, wow, thanks to that background, I learned such and such from so-and-so. And I don't want it to be that one gym teacher, you know, one Black gym teacher that I had or something, you know? And so I think that for me and for us as a family, that has been a goal, I would say. Mm. But as Charlie said, it hasn't been tension-free because it's not easy and it's hard to be deliberate.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest thing that I'll commend my parents for doing with my sister and I, is being very intentional about always having us in very diverse spaces. Mm-hmm. And that came with caveats of us being in the gifted program. And that is basically what segregation looks like in public schools. It is literally the white students getting gifted, and then everyone else is in regular or lower classes. And so when we also had the struggle of moving, because we needed to move to get into a better school, but private schools in Atlanta are just outrageously priced. And I wasn't conscious of it when I was 8 years old when we moved. And so like, I wasn't privy to all the conversations, but we've talked about it in the past, now that we've lived where we are now for a decent amount of time. My dad grew up a military brat, and so he was used to like being the one Black kid. And so that was something that he struggled a lot with and didn't want my sister and I to have. My mom was the same thing, as she's from Texas and grew up in all white spaces, and she's a very white woman. And coming to Atlanta, she was really shocked of like how much diversity was, and it was very different than what she had encountered in Texas. And so I commend my parents for being very intentional about putting my sister and I in really diverse spaces, because it allowed me to accept my own identity for how I wanted it to be, instead of what white people were telling me how I should identify or how Black I actually was or whatnot. And so I commend both of you for doing that, because I know it is very difficult, especially as academics, that that is something, now looking back on my childhood, how much that informed how I view my own identity. Yeah. I'm going to shift the conversation some and go into how more ways that you are being intentional at raising your kids. And so how are you talking about race and ethnicity with your kids? What kinds of questions are they raising right now? And how are you approaching talking about systemic racism, but also the differences of how race operates between Asian ethnicities versus Afro ethnicities and Hispanic and all these other questions?
Well, it's funny because our older son is tremendous. He's, you know, the son of two academics, sort of the stereotype in some ways. He's extremely abstract thinker, very capable of engaging with all of these issues on a pretty deep level and constantly thinking about them. And so, I mean, I feel like with him, I almost don't even need to modulate the conversation to kid speak at all. It's like he picks up on that and he gets upset if he feels like I'm talking to him like a kid. He's very sensitive to all of these things. He used to get angry, or he tells me now he still remembers getting angry when his friends would, you know, the friends he'd had for, not friends, but classmates he'd had for 3-4 years at the same school would still ask him if Suba was really his mom. I know that he struggles with passing as white because, you know, he feels like no one recognizes the difference. So, and I remember also the really cute story when he was in pre-K even, he used to say that he was half American, half Sri Lankan, and half Canadian, which is like the story of kind of how he, I think he still kind of view, you know, like there's some poetic, something poetic about like the math not adding up. Because I think it is like we say bi and multi, right? Like the biracial and multiracial, and it's like, and race moves in and out of, it's an invented category that moves in and out of so many different identities, right? And so I think he was, that just sort of an index of how aware he was of that, of even at such an age. And so like on the wall in pre-K, they used to have like, they put their picture and then like a flag underneath them, of course, you know, and he had three flags. You know, he had Sri Lankan flag, an American flag, and a Canadian flag.
And I have to add our second son, because I've been learning Chinese, and my new book is on China as well. He now says that he's also Chinese. You know, because I was in China last summer, and I speak Chinese, and his older brother speaks a little Chinese. And so he thinks that's also part of who he is. And we're always correcting him, but then laughing about it so that he keeps doing it.
You know? Yeah. He's much more. So we're all, so it's really about their personalities. Our older son is very serious about it. Our younger son is, he's younger, so he's 5, but he's also much more playful and just kind of like doesn't take things as seriously. And so I think we're learning about how to talk to him about this stuff differently.
But here's what I would say. Kids see race, they see color, they see difference. They see it from the time they are wee little ones. And I used to just get so angry when people wouldn't recognize that or would say, oh, they don't see that. Kids see color, kids see difference. And both our kids in very different ways expressed it and talked about it, and we engaged them about it. So our oldest said that daddy was orange. For a long time, he would always draw daddy orange, and he'd say, daddy's not white, he's orange. You know,
I thought it was pink.
Or pink. Or anyway, he had a shade that he.
Just want to make that clear.
Yeah. No, you're not the orange man. But but you know, just this idea that he saw shades. He always saw the shades, and he'd say, he always saw the shades of my skin. And my brothers, kind of like with you and your sister, we're all different shades of brown. And my younger brother is much, much darker than I am, and he's more like my father that way. And you know, his experience in the world has been affected by the fact that he's so much darker, you know, and that you know, he's been treated differently by police officers, for example, you know, and things like that. So I think these are realities that children are in tune with, and we've always encouraged them to go the distance and to really think through what they're saying. With it. A few years ago, our second son, he was in preschool, and he said to me, "I wish you looked more like the parents and not the teachers." Because in Atlanta, a lot of the preschool teachers are African-American, or mostly white parents. And, you know, he expressed that to his teacher as well. He'd say, like, "My mom looks like you. She doesn't look like the other parents. She looks like you," she said to him. And then the teacher talked to me about it, and she said, "Well, what do you, you know," I said, "What did you say?" And she said, "Well, I didn't know what to say, and I wanted to check with you. But I said something like, 'Yes, aren't we beautiful?'" And he, you know, said, "Yeah, I guess, yeah," you know, suddenly thinking about that. So I think kids are always talking about these, thinking about these things. And then the thing I do that I've learned to do in my family, and that's only happened in the recent times, I'd say, is I share the stories of things that happened to me now, which for years I never did. But now I do, so much so that the other day, you know, I'm sad. I come back from work and my older son says, "Was it a microaggression again, Mom?" And it was like he had the word. He said, you know, he knows the word privilege now. He'll say, "Oh, was it somebody who was just using their privilege and not thinking about you or thinking about somebody else like you?" Because sometimes, you know, the things I'm sad about when I come back from work aren't just me. They're the experiences of people around me who are being not respected or treated or spoken about in academic circles in respectful ways. And I think one thing is that we just discuss all this stuff. And this summer, we were on the streets with our kids. We took our kids to the protests. We just, not all of them, obviously, but we took our kids to
one or two
protests.
A week.
Yeah.
One or two a week.
Wow. It was kind of a social justice summer this summer.
Yeah, they were home anyway, so we were like, well, you're not going to camp. So.
And our younger son, who wanted to be a police officer till the summer, decided he no longer wants to be one unless we're going to have something different here, you know?
Wow.
He said, "I don't want to shoot white people. I don't want to shoot black people." And to me, this is important. This is important work. With all the, like, we know, I know it's complicated, but I'm not going to let the complication shy away from this work. Because I really feel like our kids, because of their different backgrounds, can be agents of change. They can be people who uplift others because they can see who needs to be uplifted and why. And I just think that it's a vision thing. Like, they can see things that others can't see. And I think we're trying to work really hard at helping them see.
When we're speaking of someone who has vision, who's able to kind of see both, like sort of understand both sides, they can play really important roles in this. I would just say that, I mean, I very much feel like my own awareness is in an embryonic stage. I mean, I'm not a young man anymore, but I'm very young still in terms of my understanding and mastery and sensitivity to these things. So I think when I'm with my children, I just try to let them see that vulnerability and let them understand that it's something that we're all learning and that adults are learning. And that's really what the last year or so has been about, is realizing that it's the whole listening piece, right? I mean, I think, and listening and affirming experiences. I'm so glad to hear Suba say that she thought that I listened to her in a good way when we first met, because, you know, I think I was capable of it, but I'm in some ways just relieved to know that I was doing it even then. But you know, I'm just trying to listen to experiences and know what my place is. I mean, I think so much of white fragility is about like just being afraid of saying the wrong thing or afraid of, you know, just afraid of those cringeworthy moments. Like, I have an Indian friend and not saying the right thing. And then therefore letting that paralyze you. And so I've adopted my new mantra is that I'm just going to stumble blindly into the situations that I stumble into and then learn from backing out of them or learn from the mistakes I make. I think that's a more effective way to be white in this scenario. I mean, I think, you know, because otherwise you're just in your bubble of privilege where you can afford to not engage So I don't know. I think that that's what, so I just try to model that vulnerability and that, just acknowledge that I'm mistake prone too. I think that's important.
But then there's very practical things, like we eat Sri Lankan food, and when we eat Sri Lankan food, we eat with our hands. We also eat Ethiopian food with our hands. We wear, very Western clothing, but every now and then I'll buy, Indian looking kurtas, and the boys will wear them to a wedding or to a special event. I'll wear saris, and I'll explain to them what I'm wearing when they ask. I'll wear a little, what they call a bindi or a puttu in Tamil, a little dot on my forehead, and explain that. We listen to a lot of music from very different parts of the world. We listen to African music. We listen to a lot of African-American music. We listen to very classical music. Our son's a violinist, but his violin teacher is an amazing African-American violinist. And I let him know how unique that is too, and what a privilege that is. So we, and then movies, Charlie's all about movies.
Yeah. I mean, that I'm writing a book on Into the Spider-Verse, and so I'm
which
working
I'm
on that
totally here for.
And so, but that's also because I think it's important. Like, there's issues raised in that movie that I'm still reckoning with. I mean, I think it's a really complicated, interesting movie about a multiracial person, even though the Hispanic side of him is less acknowledged in the movie. But I think that he's also one of those people who sees difference and who is struggling to find his place. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why this book is what I'm writing now. I mean, it's about, raising multiracial children. It's, as I learn about that, I'm trying to articulate things about that movie. Our boys love that movie. I mean, they know every word of the soundtrack. And it's just, that soundtrack is just, it's amazing. I mean, every song is all about, using Spider-Man language to articulate self-actualization and
and vulnerability, how vulnerability can be your superpower. I love that idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something we've really been talking a lot with our kids about, using the things that they feel make them weak to understand that that's actually something that can be your strength in the end, because especially as boys and future men, to be vulnerable is a beautiful thing.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. You can learn more about the project at grayskullmovement.org, and that's gray with an A. And check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter while you're at it. Talk to you soon. Bye.